If I were a rich man. Yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum.
You don't have to be an extremely rich man or woman anymore to buy fashion or fashion accessories with the names like Gucci, Prada, or Christian Dior attached to them. Our guest this hour says when luxury conglomerates took over family-owned luxury businesses, their mission has been to democratize luxury, to make it accessible to the masses. But she says this has led to inferior products, to outsourcing, and a surge in counterfeiting. We will talk this hour about the past, present, and future of the luxury industry this hour with Dana Thomas, who is the European editor for Condé Nast Portfolio. She was the cultural and fashion writer for Newsweek for 12 years and has written about style for the New York Times Magazine for many years, among other publications. She is the author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, now out in paperback. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first, in the spirit of full disclosure, I have an outfit that I got at the Land's End Outlet last year for half price on the back rack. I don't know a lot about fashion, and I don't even know how to pronounce all of the names of the designers that are in your book. But tell us, what are we talking about when we talk about the luxury industry? Who are we talking about?
Well, the luxury industry. Already, the name sort of gives away what's happened. It used to be called the luxury business, and now it's called the luxury industry. And it's when I wrote the book, it was $157 billion a year business. Now it's closing in on $200 billion a year. And it's companies such as Louis Vuitton and Hermes and Gucci and Prada and Christian Dior and Chanel selling handbags and lipsticks and scarves and all the little trinkets and accessories with their logos all over them. That's their bread and butter. Around the world in hundreds and hundreds of stores and other outlets.
Yeah. How did the luxury business get started?
Well, the luxury business, luxury itself, goes back to, the cavemen. We've always wanted to set ourselves apart somehow from others and show our wealth. And back in ancient times, the Greeks and Romans did it, and cavemen used to put bits of bone and feathers on their furs to show that they had more wealth than somebody else. And the Etruscans and the Egyptians, everybody's always had had a form of expression of wealth and greater value. But the business as we know today really got going. Sort of since Versailles, since the French Revolution in France in the last 200 years, and particularly in the last 150 years during the 19th century. And most of these companies were artisans who were just making very beautiful wares and often furnishing the royal courts of Europe. Louis Vuitton was a young man who walked across France from his little village to Paris and learned how to make trunks and became the trunk supplier to the Empress of France. Thierry Hermès also walked across France and to Paris and became a harness maker and was making harnesses for the royal courts of Spain and Russia and France.
Mm-hmm. So when did it begin to change?
And it really started to change about 20 years ago in the mid-1980s. And the first big change was a brash young French real estate developer named Bernard Arnault from northern France, who, funny enough, I found out while doing research on the book, I was at one point related to by marriage. It was he who got divorced, not I.
Mm-hmm.
But that's France for you. Everybody's somehow a cousin. It's a small country. And he bought a company called Boussac, which had been bankrupt for some time, and it was being sold by the French government. And there wasn't much in there. It was an old textile firm, but it did contain, in the big group's holdings, the old classic French couture house, Christian Dior. So he promised the French government he wouldn't sell off everything, and then he turned around and sold off everything and just kept Christian Dior and really renovated it. Now, Christian Dior was once called the General Motors of France. It was really sort of the bankable old French fashion and couture house. But by the time he got a hold of it, it was tired and it wasn't doing very well. So he decided to really renovate it. And he did this with several companies. He acquired several companies, Celine, Givenchy, Moet & Chandon. His group now is called LVMH, Louis Vuitton Moet Hennessy, and it has more than 50 luxury brands. And what he would do is he would just make the, he would hire young designers who would brighten up the designs, and he would change the focus from, you know, very beautiful, exclusive items to things that were smart, mass-oriented and logo-covered that he could then peddle to the middle market, and really rolled out stores around the world, and really focused on the brand's name and logo. With Christian Dior, they lopped off the name Christian, and now they just call it Dior because that's more, mm-hmm. and it's easier to pronounce, and it's easier to market. And they just rolled it out, and they started making their money. They would have big fancy fashion shows in Paris, still do, for $1 million a pop, mind you, where they show extravagant clothes that look really fabulous, but it's not to sell those extravagant clothes. It's to sell you perfume and scarves and handbags.
We're going to check our weather forecast and then continue talking about the luxury industry. And we'll find out why our guest says it's lost its integrity and its quality. Dana Thomas is the author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, and we welcome your questions for her. And we wonder if you would care to share with us why you buy or don't buy Prada or another designer name. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, September the 8th. Coming up later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, Ben's guest will discuss the Great New Awakening as people become aware of the power of collaboration and start taking charge of their culture and their politics. That's coming up after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We're talking with the author of the book Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, Dana Thomas. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dana Thomas, what is wrong with making these items more accessible to more people?
Nothing's wrong with it, I think. Actually, the democratization of luxury, as many of the executives labeled what they were doing, is terrific. Back, you know, a generation or two ago, there were only a couple stores in the world, and you didn't dare go into the Christian Dior store. You know, you didn't feel like you belonged there. It was a very intimidating place. You had to be a certain social niveau or class, or it was like a club. And by opening up this and making it, you know, if you have the cash and you have the desire to own something, you can walk in, and there is no more stigma, I think is terrific. But the democratization of luxury is one thing, and the, as we say in French, the banalization, making it banal, is something completely different, or the degradation. You know, 20 years ago, when Bernard Arnault took over Louis Vuitton had two stores in Paris and Nice, and they had both of those stores for more than 100 years. And if you could get Louis Vuitton products maybe at Saks Fifth Avenue or at Bergdorf Goodman or at your major, you know, each major city had a major department store. I grew up in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, and we had Garfinkels and John Wanamaker's. You would have found some Louis Vuitton products there. But if you really wanted something special, you had to go to Paris. And there was something right and very nice about the idea of going, you know, having to travel to that place and get that thing that belongs, that came from that area, and it was made there, and it was crafted there, and it was made very specially with the finest materials and the finest craftsmanship. Well, today what's happened is Louis Vuitton now has more than 400 stores around the world, and their products are now made on an assembly line, and they're just jammed out, and you can go into a store anywhere in the world and buy the same product that the woman in front of you bought and the woman behind you is going to buy. And there's nothing rare or unique or special about it anymore. It's just logo-covered, mass-produced product. And it's not. And for me, luxury is exactly that. It should be something that is special, unique, and rare. It should be made of the finest materials and the finest craftsmanship. It should be, you know, the best that money can buy, no matter what it is. It doesn't have to be something expensive. It just should be the best.
Yeah, and these items are made oftentimes in assembly lines in China or some other developing nation.
Exactly. What I had heard this, and I decided to set out and discover it when I was doing my research for the book. And so I went to Hong Kong, and I sat in my hotel room, and I said, how on earth am I ever going to find a factory in China that's producing luxury goods? We'd all heard that this, you know, it was rumored, but how was I going to do this? So I wound up just calling the five people I knew in Hong Kong and told them what I was after. And then they called five more people, and within 24 hours, I was in a factory in China. Yeah. It didn't take very long at all. And sure enough, I walked onto the floor of one of the floors of this incredible factory about an hour north of Hong Kong, and they were making luxury handbags for major luxury brands. I would say there were maybe 25 brands that were represented in this factory, and many of them said that they, you know, say publicly they don't produce in China. And there I saw them being produced in China and saw how it was being done. The girl number one was cutting the shape and passing it on, and girl number two was gluing it and passing it on, and girl number three was attaching a snap and passing it on. And they were churning out thousands and thousands of sacks, and they were either hiding the Made in China label underneath a little flap or in the inside of the bottom inner pocket of a handbag, or they were just putting a sticker on that would be ripped off when it got to Italy, and simply because they attached a handle in Italy, they could say it was made in Italy. And, you know, it's fine to make things in China. In fact, there are many companies who say that that their product is better made in China than it was in Italy or in France, because they can build a state-of-the-art factory in 2 months, and they have, you know, young workers they can train to do exactly what they want and how they want it done. But it's another thing to say that your product costs, you know, $100 to make, and that's why you're or $500 to make, and that's why you charge $1,000, when in fact it's costing you $100 to make and you're charging $1,000. And that's exactly what the markup is for luxury goods today. It's at least 12 times the production cost.
Wow.
You're just paying profits to shareholders. You're not paying for actual quality.
And this, you say, is also leading to more counterfeiting?
It is also leading to more counterfeiting. And simultaneously, and I realized it took me a while to sort of piece this together, but it was very clear. Simultaneous to the rise and massification of luxury brands, the rollout of stores everywhere, the rollout of affordable luxury or entry-level and accessories that are covered in logos, what luxury brands did is they shifted the focus of their marketing away from the beautiful quality to the logo, and they just advertised the logo like crazy and shifted our desire to buy these products from what they actually are, a beautifully handcrafted item, to what they represent. We were buying these products for the logos, and we want to be seen carrying the logos as if the logo says that we have taste and savoir-faire. And this was all a big marketing campaign. And when they did this, of course, they made us hungry for the logos. But they couldn't keep up with our demand, or there was just the idea that, you know, why should we can't necessarily afford a $1,000 handbag every time we blink. But there were a bunch of Chinese entrepreneurs who realized that there was a viable market here and started knocking off making counterfeit versions of these bags, some exact copies where they take the original, they take it apart, they scan it in computers, and they even source from the same places as the original companies do, and they make counterfeit copies that are impeccable and sell them in Canal Street in New York, Santee Alley in L.A., and markets around the country or around the world. And we buy them and pass them off as real, and we buy them for a fraction of the price because the brands themselves have devalued the integrity of their own products by just focusing on the logo and making us crave the logo.
Yeah. You had an experience with, I think it was with your husband, where you were pricing Burberry suits?
No, a Burberry raincoat, classic trench raincoat. We were in China and doing a little, I went for some business, and then I thought, well, if I'm going all the way to China, I might as well do some sightseeing too. So I took a few days with him, and we went into the heart of the countryside and went to visit the Terracotta Warriors. And And we were in this hotel in Xi'an, and which was, you know, the birthplace of civilization in the Far East. It was the beginning of the Silk Road to Europe. And there in a conference room were some young Chinese who couldn't speak a word of English selling some luxury logoed goods. There were some that were obviously counterfeit because the names were misspelled or, you know, they were just bad quality items, some fake Calvin Klein underwear and some fake Versace sweaters. But then there were some things that were looking pretty real, and there were only a couple of them, like two or three pairs of Gucci men's shoes and one or two Burberry trench coats. And my husband tried it on, one of them on, and it was a bit big, but it looked really, you know, spot on, like it was the real thing. And we asked how much they wanted for it, and it was about $100, which is a lot of money in China, you know. This is a country where they live on pennies a day. And we said, well, we'll think about it since it was a bit big. And we came back the next day, and the whole operation was gone. And I went to the concierge, and I said, well, you know, what was that? And he said, oh, those were pretty much, you know, it was, some were counterfeit, but a lot of that stuff was real. And it was either things that were left over, and they couldn't get into the containers to send overseas, or they were smuggled out of factory. You know, that's why they might only have one or two trench coats, or they had defects or flaws, you know, just like an outlet store. And he said, but they were real. And I started scratching my head and saying, wow, that's very interesting. And that's when I started to decide to snoop around and find the factories that actually produce these brands that said they didn't produce in China.
Yeah. And so you think it's important that people realize where these items are coming from and how this industry works. Otherwise, we're being hoodwinked?
Well, yes. You know, I grew up, my formative years were in the 1970s when consumerism journalism really took off. And you know, this is what you're really getting, and you are being ripped off with, on many different levels, you know, at advocacy journalism. But nobody had ever written this about the luxury fashion business. And I actually approached this from a consumer standpoint. I was not a big client of luxury goods, but I was, you know, exactly their target market, a middle market working woman with a bit of spare income that I could lavish on myself. And so I would go to the stores and buy things from time to time. And I kept finding each season that I was getting less, that the prices were going up. And then I started comparing the things I bought, you know, 2 or 3 years ago with what I was buying now, and the quality was remarkably inferior. You know, the buttons were breaking or falling off, or the sweater was becoming unraveled, or the dye was washing out after the first washing, or the suits weren't lined anymore. And I thought, well, how can this be that I'm paying more and I'm getting less? And then meanwhile, as a journalist, I'm writing these stories about how these companies are doing extraordinarily well with record profits and the business is exploding. And I thought, there's something going on here. So I decided to tackle the subject from a consumer standpoint, but using my journalism skills, because I felt like I was getting ripped off. And I thought, well, if I feel like I'm getting ripped off, I should let other people know that they might be getting ripped off too.
We're talking with Dana Thomas, author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, about how the luxury industry has sacrificed its integrity, undermined its products, and hoodwinked its customers. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
You a fur coat for Christmas. A diamond ring, a big Cadillac car, and everything. What makes me treat you the way that I do? Gee, baby, ain't I good to you?
We are talking this hour about luxury and how luxury lost its luster, according to our guest, Dana Thomas. Dana Thomas was the cultural and fashion writer for Newsweek in Paris for about 12 years. She is now the European editor for Condé Nast Portfolio and author of the book Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, now out in paperback. We welcome your thoughts and questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Once special, rare, handmade, and very expensive, luxury goods and fashions are now made in China, are now more accessible to everyone, but inferior in quality. Dana Thomas says that the luxury industry has sacrificed its integrity, undermined its products, and hoodwinked its customers. We welcome your thoughts and questions, and let's go to the phones. Bill in Deerfield is with us first. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Good morning. I wonder if there are any maybe up-and-coming new brands, new makers that are stepping in to fill the quality void that the guest sees, using the best craftsmanship and the best materials that maybe we'll be hearing of in the years to come.
Let's talk about the future of the luxury industry, Dana Thomas.
Well, in fact, there are, and that's you've jumped to the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
The closing chapter, mm-hmm. I talk about what are called luxury refugees, because often these young and not even so young designers who have decided to re-embrace luxury used to work for the big conglomerates and grew so disillusioned with the compromises and the greed of those big companies that they left and they've decided to go back to the roots of why they got into luxury in the first place, and that was to make the best that money can buy, something small, special, crafted the best way possible. So there's a whole generation now coming out, whether it's Tom Ford, who helped turn Gucci into a global brand, who now has his own small menswear company with just a couple stores and is making beautiful, beautiful menswear. I don't know if you've noticed, but Brad Pitt's been looking pretty fine lately in the way he's dressed.
He's
wearing Tom Ford's
mm-hmm.
clothes. And actually, Tom's now going to be dressing James Bond in the new movie. So you'll see what he's doing there. And his clothes are just, they're now, they're exactly the opposite of what he was doing at Gucci, in that they're very beautifully made. There's no logo anywhere. He actually doesn't have a logo. And it's just menswear. He's not doing anything else. And so there are new, and they're small, and that's part of the beauty of it, that we don't even really know who all these people are and what they're doing. They might have one shop, or maybe they'll just have a little section of in a department store in a local store that carries multi brands, and they just have a very small production, and you have to seek them out and find them.
Yeah. Is that it then, though, Tom Ford?
Oh no! I mean, I wrote about in the book a shoe designer named Christian Louboutin, who used to design shoes for all the big houses, and then about 10 years ago launched his own company. There's a woman, she wasn't a luxury refugee, but she still does it the old-fashioned way in Paris, named Poupi Cadol, whose great-grandmother invented the bra. And she makes lingerie still made to measure. She has one shop. You have to go to Paris to get Cadol. She comes to New York once or twice a year and sees clients in a hotel suite and will take measurements and do fittings there. But if you really want her things, you got to go to Paris. There's all sorts of, and there's students who are now doing this as well. They're coming out. I spoke at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York last year, and a student said, "Well, I want to get into the business. I want to start my own company. What should I do? I don't want to work for a big group and compromise my integrity. I can't start in New York because the big groups make it all impossible. It's too expensive. There's nobody. You can't afford to hire anybody because they've taken up all the retail space. They've taken up all the staff." And I said, "Well, where are you from?" She said, "Charlottesville, Virginia." I said, "Go back to Charlottesville, Virginia, and start there, and become the best shop in Charlottesville, Virginia. You'll be doing yourself a favor because you'll have an actual chance to make it, and you'll be single-handedly raising the taste level of Charlottesville, Virginia."
Yeah, talk some about the store, the department store, the luxury store that you visited in, was it Brazil?
Yes, in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Mm. Well, that's a perfect example of it. It's called Dazlu, and while it's a gigantic place, it took us 3 days to visit it, and they sell everything and anything you can imagine. You think of it, they have it. They have a pharmacy, they have a bank, they have even a chapel you can get married there. They have a stationer so you can do your wedding invitations. They have a bakery so you can do your wedding cake. They have reception rooms. They have couture. They sell cars. They have a travel agencies where they'll book you a trip to anywhere. They sell all the luxury items. It's an incredible place. And it was founded by this woman's mother 50 years ago, very simply, where she would sell beautiful things. She would go to Rio, where the retail buyers would go and buy outfits and things and bring them back to Sao Paulo and sell them to her friends in her living room. But the beauty of Dazlu is that there's only one. And you, mm-hmm. if you want to go to Dazlu, you have to go to Sao Paulo. And that's already sort of part of the luxury of it. That, you know, there isn't a Dazlu in New York. There isn't a Dazlu in L.A., Chicago, Paris, Tokyo, and London. You have to go to Sao Paulo. There already is the unique side of this place. The other thing is that she's the owner is very involved with the store. She says, I don't sit in my office and look at the computer screen and crunch numbers. She goes down on the floor. She knows the customer. She sells things. She finds things for them. Just, even though it may be a big place in the end, in its mentality, it's still a very small local shop. And that's what's missing today in our retailing world. You know, mm-hmm. and it's not just in luxury, it's in all retailing that we've gone mass, we've gone homogenized, that we have chains of everything everywhere, and that everyone who works in them are employees, they're not owners, and it's not their store, and it's all managed from a corporate office in New York and people looking at screens and crunching numbers. And it's become very impersonal, and there's no uniqueness left. It's just all monotonous, and we're missing that personal, you know, interaction. Mm-hmm. The local haberdasher, where your husband would go and he would get a suit, and if it didn't fit him quite right, there was a tailor in the back who fixed it. Or your local dressmaker, where you go and you pick out, you like that suit, but you didn't like that color fabric, and you pick out the fabric and you have it made, and it didn't cost you an arm and a leg. It cost you probably less than what's being charged for ready to wear, where they have hundreds of the same ones on the rack right next to each other.
Yeah.
And they don't fit you, and they're badly made, and they're not lined. You know, I feel like there's a bit of a backlash, happily, going on now in our shopping behavior, that we want to find something that is unique, something that suits us. If we're going to pay for something, we should pay for quality and craftsmanship and service, and not just for profits for shareholders and luxury houses for the owners in the south of France. We should, you know, it's a bit like the food business, where now there's the rise of the local farmers market. We want to know the farmer who grew those tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
I think we want to also know the person who made that suit. And through the outsourcing to China and other places, and through the, you know, massification and homogenization of everything, we've so lost touch with the product and the product chain and it's become incredibly impersonal, and we need more interaction and personal feeling in our purchases and in our everyday life.
Dana Thomas is our guest. She is the author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, now out in paperback. 1-800-642-1234, our toll-free number, if you have a question for her, or email us, talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 13 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Monday, September the 8th. On our State Capitol Report, coming up after 7 o'clock, a look at the influence of money in Wisconsin politics. I'll talk with a guest who says political donations influence state policy, and on the eve of the state primary elections, that money will be pouring in. That's coming up in our next hour on the State Capitol Report. Right now, we're talking about how luxury has lost its luster with Dana Thomas, author of the book Deluxe, currently the European editor for Condé Nast Portfolio, formerly with the cultural and fashion writer for Newsweek in Paris. And we'll go to the phones in just a moment, and our lines are full at the moment. You can still email us a question at talk@wpr.org. Dana Thomas, I had mentioned that I'm no fashion plate, but I smiled when you, in our first half hour, talked about how everybody in France is a cousin of someone. My distant relative, a cousin, is Pierre, we pronounce it Cardine. He pronounces it Cardan or
Cardan.
Yeah, yeah, and Pierre is a distant relative of mine. We take the Italian pronunciation of that French name, but I've picked up a few items with his name attached to it because of that connection. But his name was on everything. He's pretty much, clothing and the kitchen sink and umbrellas and everything else. Is that an example of this? spreading yourself too thin, the democratization of luxury?
It is. In fact, he's the one who got the ball rolling. He's the one who started the buy my items because of me, not because they're fabulous items. And he put his signature on everything and basically sold his signature to people. And was a marketing genius, you know. He would advertise, and he would dress people on television shows. Remember, he would dress hosts on game shows talk show hosts, and it would say, and clothes provided by Pierre Cardin. He's the one who really started focusing on the name of the brand. And he didn't have a logo, per se, but his signature was his logo. And it became sort of like a stamp of approval, a good housekeeping seal of approval. And that, you know, logos go back to... You know, we've had logos since the dawn of time, and you know, and they were signatures, they were stamps, they were marks that this had been made by this person, and we had trademark legislation about 100 years ago, and that's exact. And it grew out of the Industrial Revolution as a way to set apart something that had been handcrafted from something that had been mass produced, and that's why, you know, we. So you would say, well, this has been signed by this person. He crafted it. It wasn't just, you know, churned out in a factory. And now it's become sort of so twisted and reworked that now it's churned out in a factory, and the logo doesn't even state that. It just states that it came from this company.
Mm-hmm.
And we've really adopted we bought into the marketing.
To the phones we go. Joseph in Madison joins us next. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good.
Good morning.
Hi. I was born in Manhattan in the 40s and grew up there. And my aunt actually lived at 10 West 58th Street, which was right next to the Paris Theater. It was a little old mansion.
Nice.
And so, you know, her apartment looked right into the second floor of the plaza. And you know, Bergdorf's was on the corner, and F.A.O. Schwartz was across the street from there. And then Sherry Netherlands. And I think... with the luxury thing, I was trying to figure out what makes this sort of different. And I think it has to do with the product and also the time. And I was talking to the man who was initially answered the phone, and I said, you know, it was in a way in that little neighborhood, because, you know, Tiffany's was on 57th and 5th around the corner, and the tailored ladies and all these things that don't exist any longer. And it was really sort of small-townish, strangely enough, because I think it was a certain... class of people, I hate to use that word, but who bought in these stores. And the stuff was very good, and it also lasted a very long time. And I think that it was more accepted, and it wasn't, strangely enough, it wasn't a snobbish sort of situation, but I think certain people bought in those stores, and they didn't flash about it. They just, that's what they bought, and they had the money to do that. It wasn't quite as splashy as I think it is today in some of the things. And it was just, I think it has to do with the way the world was in those days, where things were just accepted that you went in and that's how you bought. No one, you know, really got crazy about it. It's just a lot of people would, I mean, initially I think people, very famous people, would buy certain things maybe, and then within a couple of months there would be a knockoff on 8th Avenue, and then they would go on the rack and people would buy copies. It's probably fairly similar today, I think.
What about that, Dana Tennis?
Well, there was definitely that. Originally, until 20 years ago, luxury was a niche business for a niche clientele. And it made, you know, a very limited amount of items for a very limited group of people who understood the quality and appreciated and lived, you know, also that sort of same restrained but good quality life in everything that they did. It wasn't, and they didn't, like you said, it wasn't about flash. It wasn't about showing off. They didn't talk about it. They just had it. They were very discreet. The brands were, the companies were discreet, their items were discreet, and their customers were discreet. And that's where the shift came, because when the businessmen and the business tycoons took over these companies, they decided not to keep this discreet aspect of it, but in fact bury that and turn it into, you know, to make it global and to make it mass, you had to shout, you know, come buy our stuff, and you had to make it really flamboyant and sexy and show off. And so that's when they started focusing on the logo, and they started covering everything with the logos, and then you were shouting that I'm carrying this. You know, before, those double C's on a Chanel bag were on the inside of the bag.
Mm.
And your initials were on the outside. And that was how it was with everything. It was your initials on things. It wasn't somebody else's. But we have now, through the marketing, we were targets of this marketing, and we've bought into this idea that it means more to have somebody else's, to wear somebody else's initials rather than our own, which I find really interesting, and I'm thinking of investigating on my next book.
Well, you know, when you mentioned C's on the handbag, I thought of Coach handbags first thing.
10 years ago, there was no Coach logo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a very new creation. And I remember when I first started seeing it, I'm like, what is that C? Because there wasn't one. They created a logo to stamp on the outside so that people would buy more of them.
Yeah, I had somebody ask me if I was carrying a Coach handbag, and I didn't even know what they're talking about at the time. But that is, you can spend hundreds and hundreds of $1,000s on a Coach handbag.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. He mentioned Bergdorf Goodman. Bergdorf Goodman, for me, is still sort of this wonderful temple and, you know, the epicenter for luxury in the United States. They've managed to, while it is owned by the same group as Neiman Marcus, it's a bit like Dazzlu in Sao Paulo that we spoke about earlier. There's only one Bergdorf Goodman. And you have to go to New York to go to it. And they really do sell some very special items. And they go and they really hunt around to find things that are rare and unique and that you will only find in their store.
Let me take some more callers. Jake in Oshkosh is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, I understand that basically these corporations are cutting the cost by about 5 and selling it for the same price. Is that what I kind of got before?
Oh, they're cutting it more than 5, yeah.
So they're cutting the bottom line, so obviously they love it. So partly their greed is the problem, but how much of it is caused by the consumer willing to put up with this? You know, I think this is a problem in other industries that have consumers overall. Everything's quality is, you know, lower, yet people are still willing to pay for it and sometimes happy to pay for it.
Exactly. And that's something I've been sort of thinking about now and wondering if this is what I should explore next in the next book. We are definitely to blame in that sense that we have been gullible in accepting the marketing. And it's not just, you know, somebody told me recently, your book isn't about luxury fashion. It's about everything. It's about commerce today. You just used luxury fashion as a conduit. I said, exactly. You got it. You got it. And I could be talking about food. I could be talking about automobiles. I could be talking about, in fact, the man who told me that worked for GM. I could be talking about just about any business today. And in fact, what happened was that the luxury fashion business, not only was it bought by tycoons, but these were used to be privately owned companies by families that, you know, were very small companies who did a very small profit and very small business. And now the tycoons put it on the stock market. They're publicly traded, and their primary goal is to make profits for shareholders. It's, you know, about the bottom line. So they are very well-run businesses from a business standpoint, but they've had to sacrifice their integrity in their product and in their mission in order to be very well-run businesses and deliver those profits to the shareholders.
And who are
the people who are getting the brunt of the sacrifice of the integrity, but the consumer?
We have one more caller that we can fit in. Chris in Whitewater. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'll make this real quick. I know we're cutting it short. I was just curious if the guest had any thoughts on the influx of the indie craft and art scene and how the makers who are involved with things such as Art Tourist Craft here in Milwaukee or the Renegade Craft Fair, which scours across the country. The makers that are involved with those have absolutely nothing more but their craftsmanship to depend on to sell their work, and they're only selling pieces that are made as good as they possibly can be made, and the prices are affordable to individuals. But these people aren't belonging to the big design houses that...
Chris, thank you very much. I'm sorry we have less than a minute to go for Dana Thomas to quickly respond to that.
Well, you know, they're perfectly the example of what I'm hoping to achieve with the book, which is to get us to start questioning the integrity of our purchases as well. Are we buying really what we say we think we're buying? And if we're not, then let's not do it. Let's just, you know, why buy a tomato that's been ripened in a truck when we can buy an heirloom that from a farmer down the road? And I think it's the same in anything that we purchase today. We are the power, we are the consumer, and we're the ones who should dictate what's going on, not the big businesses.
What a nice place to end it for now. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dana Thomas, author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster. Thanks to Carmen Jackson, to Bill Martins, and to Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.